listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Despite a ceasefire declared Saturday at the UN Security Council by a unanimous vote, shelling continued in the eastern Ghouta district of Syria by armed militants. RT's Murat Gazdiev has more.
Russian Reconciliation Center, Ceasefire Monitoring Center in Syria, says that over the last 24 hours, rebels in East Ghouta launched no less than 31 shells into Damascus. And I know what that looks like. Every time we've stayed in Damascus, every time we've been in Damascus, we have heard those shells landing all over the capital, all over Damascus, because East Ghouta is the last rebel stronghold in the vicinity of the capital, their last stranglehold, you know, the revolution's echoes, because all other enclaves around the capital have been retaken by the Syrian government. Nevertheless, these incidents of shelling, they're very random. They shell blindly, you know. A shell might land in a market, it might land in a military base, in a hospital, in a government building. And usually there's a lot of casualties. Over the last 24 hours, a dozen casualties, say Syrian authorities. But the rebels in East Ghouta, Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, which holds, which is the most powerful rebel group in East Ghouta, it says that it is abiding by this ceasefire. It says that it is being shelled and bombed by the Syrian government, and that is indeed happening. There are airstrikes, from what we've gathered from the various reports, there are airstrikes ongoing against East Ghouta, against Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam. But the Syrians are saying that, you know, the rebels are shooting at us, and the rebels are saying the Syrians are shooting at us. So there's no ceasefire to speak of quite yet.
Late Monday, Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, held a press conference on the situation in Syria.
Colleagues, as you know, The day before yesterday, the UN Security Council decided to approve the resolution number 2401, and according to the order of the President of the Russian Federation, we, in order to prevent civilian casualties in the region of the Eastern Ghouta, decided to install, starting from the February 27th, a humanitarian pause from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. That will allow the civilians to leave through the created humanitarian corridor. The coordinates will be circulated soon. At the same time, we understand that the Eastern Ghouta in Syria is not the only hotspot currently when it comes to the plight of people and civilians. We do know that there is a refugee camp called Rukban, controlled by the U.S., and we suggest that the same kind of corridors and pauses shall be installed and organized in the area of El-Tanf and Rukban for the civilians to leave and come back to their homes without any obstacles on the way, so that they can start to reconstruct their homes, come back to peaceful life. We suggest that as soon as possible, the United Nations, for instance, can be the guiding body and the platform for the creation of an international evaluation commission that could look into the real situation in Raqqa, where, unfortunately, we see no one allowed to come. Neither the media nor humanitarian organization are granted access. We see no work on humanitarian aid deliverance, no reconstruction works underway there. This is why people cannot get back to their homes in Raqqa. So these are the orders we've received. To my mind, just as it was before, when we conducted other operations, and we will succeed in ensuring the humanitarian pause, letting people who've been prevented from fleeing the besieged cities by the militants who use them as a human shield, will finally be released, will flee the besieged areas, and the general staff is therefore ordered to start working on the matter.
Again, Monday's fighting on the ground in Syria comes after Saturday's unanimous vote at the UN Security Council calling for a ceasefire. These are the closing comments made by Syria's permanent representative, Bashar al-Ja'afari.
Thank you, Mr. President. In the course of the past 2 days, among the thousands of missiles that were targeting the Syrian capital, the headquarters of the Red Crescent in Damascus was targeted with 10 missiles. It is the main headquarters of the Red Crescent in Syria, which is in a neighborhood called Abu Ramani in Damascus. These missiles were launched by the moderate armed groups in Al-Ghouta. Of course, thousands were dead, including a doctor called Hassan. He's a professor at the Technological Health Institute in Damascus. He received condolences from a friend who is French called Thierry Marianne. He's a colleague. Thierry Mariani said the following, and I quote in French.
Hundreds of others. Over the past 5 years, Dr. Hassan Hassan was killed by shells launched from Ghouta in Damascus by the moderate rebels. These dead have no right, are not entitled to media compassion. Oh, they are on the wrong side of history. And then he concludes by stating, when will there be a balance? So this is a French citizen that truly describes the suffering of people in Damascus as a result of the terrorists launching missiles from Al-Ghouta. By the way, Mr. Thierry visited Aleppo in 2017, and the gangs of the Free Syrian Army back then fired rockets in the airport when he was leaving Aleppo. Thank God he wasn't affected, but since then the Aleppo airport remained closed. This airport has not been safe since then, and this is why it was closed. The head of the Syrian Red Crescent in Idlib, Dr. Mohammed Al-Witi, was kidnapped by moderate armed groups. My colleague, the permanent representative of France, said that we must observe a truce. And I say, yes, you are right. However, we also need to implement 29 other Security Council resolutions on the situation in Syria, among them 13 on counterterrorism. So we don't only need a cessation of hostilities for a month. No, we also need the implementation of 29 resolutions that you adopted. My colleague, the British ambassador, presented horrific tales that he heard from other people, as he said. Apparently, he didn't listen to the horrific tales and the violations perpetrated by his forces in Iraq, Palestine, and Libya. The British government, my dear sir, went to Malvinas and fought Argentina for an island that it doesn't own, an island that lies thousands of kilometers away from the United Kingdom. However, your honorable government, and note here that I'm not using the term regime because I respect international law, your honorable government are preventing us from countering terrorism on our own territories. We didn't go thousands of kilometers away. We didn't go and fought other countries. We are combating terrorism on our territories. Terrorism that is supported by the government of your country. Mr. President, in the session on Thursday, I explained the reality of what is happening in Syria, the reality of the suffering of civilians as a result of the practices of armed terrorist groups. I stress once again that the government of the Syrian Arab Republic has taken seriously all de-escalation initiatives and observed them to protect the lives of our citizens and to stop those trading with their blood. In this regard, I note that the Syrian government has complied with the Astana agreement on establishing de-escalation zones. It stipulated a number of commitments, among them compelling the signatory armed groups to sever any ties they have with terrorist organizations, especially ISIS and Al-Nusra Front, and any other affiliated groups. The agreement, the Astana agreement, at the same time, gave the Syrian government the right to respond in case of any violations by those armed groups. It was not surprising at all to us that these armed terrorist groups would not comply with any of those initiatives. They would use these agreements as an opportunity to reorganize its forces, to reorganize its fighters, to receive more military equipment, logistical support, and to perpetuate its crimes against the Syrian
people. They're, of course, receiving instructions from member states. Some are members of this council and some regional actors that are practicing state terrorism to ensure the obstruction and failure of those initiatives and agreements. Mr. President, since the signing of the agreement on the establishment of de-escalation zones, these armed groups have systematically violated the agreement. In responding to these violations, the Syrian government has exercised extreme self-restraint to protect the lives of civilians and to salvage this agreement that armed terrorist groups and the countries that sponsor them are trying to obstruct from the moment of the signing. However, these violations have become repeated and serious and have affected the lives of 8 million civilians living in Damascus. Missiles and rockets are being launched, car bombs are being used, and Syrian military sites are being targeted. All this has led to a situation that we cannot condone. We bear a responsibility as a state towards our citizens, and we have a sovereign right to counter terrorism. We're also receiving appeals, repeated appeals from Syrian citizens asking for protection for their families, for their children, for their schools, protection from the practices of these armed terrorist groups. In light of these violations and these terrorist actions, the Syrian government had to take the necessary steps to protect our citizens. We exercised our legitimate right to defend them, and at the same time, we took all necessary steps to ensure the safety of civilians that those groups are taking hostage and using as human shields inside Eastern Ghouta. We also ensured a safe passage to ensure the exit of civilians in cooperation with our friends in Russia from 4 to 14th of February to ensure the exit of civilians. We provided shelter and food and necessary medical care. The government paid for all those steps. We called upon armed groups to lay down their arms and to stop their terrorism and stop targeting residential areas and to engage in national reconciliation initiatives. Of course, the appeals of 8 million Syrians do not reach the Secretariat and do not reach the mailbox of the representative of the United States, the UK, and France. Although they do receive appeals from their proxies, armed terrorist groups, and the appeals of white helmet terrorists, the new legitimate representative of Al-Nusra Front. It seems that these countries decided today to replace the black flags of ISIS and Al-Qaeda with white flags in Iraq and white helmets in Syria. So we're done with the black color, now we're using the white color. Mr. President, the basic principle that governs the delivery of humanitarian aid, according to Resolution 182/46 that we negotiated on and reached consensus on, is the respect of the sovereignty of the country concerned and coordinate with it fully in any activity that the United Nations is engaged in on the territories of this country. However, these principles lose all value and are subject to the political whims and double standards of the Secretariat and some of the influential countries when it is about implementing those principles in Syria. How else can we explain that some countries table draft resolutions on the situation in Syria and negotiate these draft resolutions for many weeks with all actors, with all parties, with the exception of the country concerned? This is what I stated the day before yesterday. How do we explain that the resident coordinator in Damascus sends to the Syrian foreign minister a note on the 14th of February 2018 stressing that aid convoys reached 2.3 million people in the so-called besieged and hard-to-reach areas during 2017, while the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs presented completely false figures to tarnish the image of the Syrian government and to give to Western countries in the Security Council justifications to target the Syrian government and its partners. So the resident coordinator said that aid had reached 2.3 million people. Mr. Lowcock, 2 days ago, said that aid has reached only 20,000 people. Mr. President, we have said repeatedly, along with some members of this council, over the past 7 years, that to end the suffering of civilians, we do not need non-consensual draft resolutions. We do not need to adopt news resolutions. We do not need holding ordinary or emergency sessions. We do not need to deplete UN resources to prepare periodic reports that rely on unreliable sources. We do not need to establish a committee here and a body there. We need to implement the 29 Security Council resolutions. Now they've become 30 resolutions. What a coincidence. By adopting the resolution today, we have reached 30 resolutions. So please implement them. The governments of some countries should stop spending millions of dollars to support terrorists in Syria. The latest we've heard is that the USA has allocated $4 billion in its actions in Syria. Those countries must stop opening its borders and airports to facilitate the flow of terrorist fighters. They must allow the Syrian people to shape its future and regain the stability of the region without any foreign interference. You, President, Mr. President, you said that the Council rejects anything that violates the principles and purposes of the Charter. This is very precise. And you called for the implementation of this resolution in all parts of Syria. This is how we interpret this resolution. This resolution needs to be implemented in all parts of Syria, including Afrin, including the areas controlled by the United States, including the Golan. What we also need, ladies and gentlemen, is for the governments of these countries, and I say very clearly who they are, the USA, the UK, and France, these governments should stop holding meetings in Washington, Paris, and London. It should stop establishing groups and bodies and forums. It should stop devising strategic plans. That's what they're called, strategic plans, reminiscent of the colonial times. They must be aware that these strategic plans to divide Syria, that's what they're called. They got together in Washington and announced that they devised a plan to divide Syria within 1 year. I'm just telling you what they said. These strategic plans to divide Syria and to change the political system by force, here again, I am quoting from the document that was adopted in Washington. They should stop these strategic plans to spread terrorism and ensure the illegitimate military presence on our territories. I say that to my colleague from the United States, as threatened us before you all, and no one has responded to her. I'm saying that all this will not succeed and it will backfire sooner or later. According to Article 51 of the Charter, my country has the right to defend ourselves with all legal tools. There is a military presence, a colonial presence, a U.S. presence in our country, and we have the right to respond to that. She threatened us, and we're threatening her from this rostrum because we have the right to defend ourselves according to Article 51 of the Charter. We stress once again that double standards will continue to mar international efforts to counter terrorism as long as we stick to this limited and flawed approach in dealing with armed groups in Syria. Today, some of you are claiming that they're concerned about an area controlled by terrorist armed groups in eastern Ghouta. The area is 50 square kilometers. The area you're talking about has an area of 50 square kilometers. They are while ignoring and disregarding three illegal occupation of Syrian territories and the area of those territories amounts to 50,000 square kilometers. So we're talking about 50 square kilometers, and we're ignoring an area of 50,000 square kilometers. I'm talking here about American, Turkish, and Israeli occupation. This simple comparison reflects the political hypocrisy of some member states and the incapacity of the Security Council and the other United Nations bodies, as this organization is succumbing to political and financial polarization, which has become the main feature of the working methods of the organization. Mr. President, in conclusion, we will continue to support our allies to counter terrorism wherever it is in Syria, wherever it is. We are exercising a sovereign right of self-defense and a constitutional right in our territories and within our national borders, not in Malvinas.
Asia.
And we're not sending conquering forces thousands of kilometers away, just as the so-called international coalition is doing. We're not doing as the French forces are doing in Mali and in African countries, not as what the United States and the United Kingdom are doing in Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq. We're countering terrorism within our territories. We didn't go to Mali, we didn't go to Niger, we didn't go to Argentina. What we need today is a serious engagement by those governments who are giving instructions to armed terrorist groups. They should give instructions to those groups to stop immediately. And I say immediately and not without delay, as this resolution stipulates, to stop immediately targeting civilians, stop immediately with terrorist actions. I stress that our government will reserve the right to respond as it deems appropriate in case those terrorist armed groups are targeting civilians in any part of Syria with even one single missile. I take into account that we understand the first operative paragraph of this resolution, this new resolution, as follows. It applies also to the aggression of Turkish forces in Afrin and the operations of the anti-ISIL coalitions in Syria. Of course, this resolution applies to the aggression of Israeli forces in Syria, especially the occupied Syrian Golan. This is how we interpret the resolution just adopted, Mr. President. Thank you very much.
Aside from Russia, Syria has found an ally in Iran in its battle with the various terrorist groups seeking to topple the government in Damascus. This was Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, speaking in Belgrade Monday.
As you know, Iran, along with Russia and Turkey, have tried and succeeded for bringing down the level of hostilities in Syria over the past year. We continue to believe that Syria requires a political solution and there is no military solution in Syria. We also believe that there is a need for the international community to come together to assist the people of Syria to fight against terrorism and extremism, which has unfortunately ravaged the country and brought a lot of bloodshed to the country over the past many years. So we hope that the resolution by the Security Council will bring about reduction of hostilities and an end to activities by terrorist organizations, as well as reduction of hostilities both in Damascus and in other parts of Syria, in order for the Syrian people to be able to move through the political process that started in Sochi last month.
Also on Monday, the European Union's foreign minister, Federica Mogherini, called on Iran, Russia, and Turkey as guarantors to ensure that a process of de-escalation takes place in Syria.
We had a long and very constructive and positive meeting with the foreign ministers of the countries of the League of Arab States, plus the Secretary General of the League of Arab States. We expect full and immediate implementation of the UN Security Council resolution that was just adopted in New York the other day, for which I would like to thank the role that played Kuwait as chair of the Council, but also of all the members of the European Union that are currently members of the UN Security Council, that have worked night and day, literally, to achieve consensus on resolution that for us is very important, in particular Sweden. I will send a letter today to the three foreign ministers of the three guarantors of the Astana process, Russia, Turkey and Iran, to ask them to, as guarantors of the Astana process, work for the implementation of the UN Security Council resolution, and in particular for the implementation of the de-escalation zones that were decided in Astana and for which they have a role to play.
Meanwhile, more forces from Turkey crossed the border into Syria as Ankara was widening its offensive against Kurdish militants despite the UN calls for a ceasefire. Political analyst Adam Gary, based in London, spoke with Press TV's Kovi Tavwe about the Turkish offensive and about the apparent impotence of the UN Security Council.
Well, the UN has been largely discredited by the malevolent antics of Nikki Haley and her cohorts. As for the general terms of the ceasefire, Russia was very careful and frankly very clever to put in a crucial provision which says that terrorist groups as recognized by the UN are exempted from the ceasefire. This is what has allowed the Syrian Arab Army and its partners to continue draining the swamp of Takfiri jihadist snakes from the East Ghouta region, which have threatened the safety and livelihood of many innocent people in the Syrian capital of Damascus. In respect of the YPG, Turkey, which is a part of the Astana group, which also includes Russia and Iran, views them as a terrorist group, and their sister organization, PKK, is widely regarded by most international players as a terrorist group. The Afrin Front in the Syrian conflict wasn't specified in the discussions surrounding the UN resolution, so there is a bit of room for ambiguity. Turkey is pursuing it one way, the French President Macron is clearly interested in pursuing it another way. Finally, because Turkey is part of the Astana group, the lingering disputes that Syria and Turkey have must only be addressed through a political process. No one stands to gain anything through a direct confrontation between the Turkish military and the Syrian Arab Army. For that, there's the Astana process, and there are other diplomatic channels which Russia has encouraged all parties to use. That's the only sensible way forward in that respect.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Rather than providing clarity and closure, the indictment of 13 Russian nationals on charges of conspiracy has further entrenched both sides of the Russiagate narrative. Those who believe that Kremlin tried to hack the American democracy deepened their conviction, as did those who insist that the whole story was an invention of sore losers. Whatever was or wasn't Russia's role in the 2016 US presidential campaign, perception is reality. How should Moscow navigate it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Fedor Lukyanov, one of Russia's top geopolitical analyst and editor-in-chief of Russian Global Affairs magazine. Mr. Lukyanov, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for coming over. Now, first, let me ask you about the so-called St. Petersburg troll factory. In Western media, it's presented as this huge, ominous operation. But if you look at the sheer number of people involved and the size of the budget, it's not even a factory. It's a tiny little sweatshop. We employ more people at RT's cafeteria than were actually indicted. Why do you think it's gotten this larger-than-life notoriety?
Yeah, maybe you should promote your cafeteria to make more.
Well, I think our people at cafeteria know English pretty much as well as the people who were running that factory.
I was a bit disappointed by this disclosure because I believed, based on what U.S. media and Western media wrote before, that Russia is really almighty, that we are everywhere, that our specialists, including trolls, are really comprehensive and overwhelming. If it is only 13 persons doing this kind of business, and I have no doubt that this business does exist, because that's part of any PR and mass communication and strategic communication activities anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I already, I think I read somewhere in US press that some people who seriously analyzed that, they say that basically what they did is part of activities of many commercial
social media campaign, yeah, as they called it. But you know that the problem with the Americans is that they believe that the person who is behind it is Vladimir Putin himself, the president of Russia. And I know that most foreigners believe that Russia is this very tightly controlled society. And politically, that may be the case sometimes. But I wonder if you allow for a possibility that Yevgeny Prigozhin, who conceived and funded this operation, who is sometimes referred to as Putin's former chef, was actually doing that on his own as an experiment with social media rather than following or trying to execute direct orders from the Kremlin?
I have no idea about relationship between Mr. Prigozhin and Mr. Putin, but based on my modest knowledge about how Russian society and Russian administration work in general, I doubt, because the specificity of current Russian system, unlike the Soviet system, where everything was really centralized and very much well organized. Now we have the opposite situation. Yes, the state obviously uses some, how to call it, non-traditional means sometimes to compensate for obvious weaknesses of Russian system, because it's no secret that in many components of influence, power, economy, capacity, Russia is much weaker than the United States. But it can be compensated by some asymmetric moves.
But what I'm asking you about is the propensity of the of Russia to produce these ad hoc actions. What you're saying is that, yes, the Russian state sometimes outsources.
Sometimes.
But I think also what many foreigners don't understand is the scope which the Russian system allows for personal and sometimes even malevolent initiative.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I wanted to say, that sometimes it's the case that it's true that the state is using it. But in many other cases, this is a strange mixture of private initiative, commercial initiative. Sometimes there are people with some political views and ideas. They do it. They maybe believe that they do it on behalf of Russian state, but it's not
To develop a competency that the Russian state, the Kremlin, may cheer upon without actually the Kremlin asking the Kremlin first.
Absolutely. And to believe that Mr. Putin controls and instructs everything with what is happening in Russia or on Russian behalf outside the country, that would be great, but it's not the case. We see that our society is much, much, much worse organized, actually.
And I think Vladimir Putin's own competency when it comes to social media is rather questionable. It is well known that he's not using smartphones, so his knowledge of that tool of communication is also
Russian
rather
Prime
questionable.
Minister is much better on that. Maybe he's in charge.
So maybe he's the one who should be indicted after all. Now, if you look at some of the output of that troll sweatshop, it uses subgrammatical language, what we would call Runglish rather than American English. It, I think, shows very poor knowledge of the American domestic politics, a very brash style to it all. It looks very amateur, the level of a high school newspaper at best. And yet a lot of very well-placed and very well-educated people in the United States take it as nothing less than either a declaration or an act of waging war on the United States. And when you see such a gap between reaction and an action, there must be something else involved, perhaps some other unarticulated fears. What could that be?
The United States is going through a very deep domestic crisis. This is a political crisis, but more than that, this is a crisis of self-perception. And that's very much understandable, because United States, after the Cold War, got used to feel itself as the ultimate master of the world, of the universe, for understandable reasons, because after the Cold War, for quite a long time, it was no country who could challenge United States.
Oh, even and contradict for that matter.
Even contradict, and conceptually, there were no ideas who could be offered as an alternative. Now, the challenge to American supremacy came not from the outside, not from Russia, not from China, but from the inside of society. Mm-hmm. And that came as such a big shock to U.S. establishment that I think what we see now around Russia and this hyperbolization of Russian activities is psychologically understandable attempt mm-hmm. to find somebody outside the United States who is responsible for that while the real problem is inside.
Mm-hmm. You often quote George H.W. Bush, who said that America won the Cold War by the grace of God, which definitely solidified the U.S. perception as a sort of God-chosen nation with a mission. And I think, and you also said on a number of occasions that you see the current tensions as either the withering or perhaps the painful death of that very mission, which actually began before Trump. It started under Obama. But what Trump is offering, you know, this America First slogan, it could be used as a legitimate policy, but this is not a self-narrative. It does not answer the question of who we are as a nation. What could possibly come to replace that sense of mission of, you know, sort of pushing the world towards democratic salvation?
To the limited extent I know United States, the idea of exceptionalism and U.S. mission is indispensable. So this is really one of grounds and foundations of U.S. statehood and U.S. political culture, political psychology. So it will not change. I think United States now are, Americans now are facing the period of uncertainty, which is to be used to readapt to this new world. So because dominance is impossible, and it started, understanding of this started not even during Obama's presidency, but after Iraq war, even mm-hmm. Bush presidency mm-hmm. started to realize this imperial overstretch, frequently used notion from 2000s, was just the reaction to America started to understand limits of capacity of the country, which is maybe most powerful in mankind's history, mm-hmm. but still. And in this regard, I think next, I don't know, 8, 10, 15 years, maybe 10, U.S. will try to find new ways how to accommodate America to this new world. But it will be back. This idea about supremacy, not supremacy, supremacy is still here mm-hmm. because Trump is about supremacy.
Of it's, having to project the values over the rest of the world. It will be back.
Trump is about to project power. Next, maybe not next, but the president in 10 years' time will be back to the idea to project values as mm-hmm. well.
Now, as Americans like to say, perception is reality, and on some level it doesn't really matter whether Russia intervened or not. As you pointed out, this Russia meddling theme has already taken on the life of its own. It created the legal infrastructure which allows for the increased pressure on Russia with or without any particular pretext. I wonder, how do you think it should change the Kremlin's calculation of risks?
It's sometimes strange to us in Russia, but yes, of course, the perception of vulnerability of the U.S. democracy has now becoming common wisdom in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we can agree or disagree, but this is fact of life, which will influence decision-making in the United States for years to come.
You said in one of the interviews that the main thing that Putin has been trying to teach the West is essentially a cause and effect relationship. If you take action, there will be consequences. And I think what this whole Russiagate story taught him is that sometimes there is an effect without a cause, or an effect that is hugely disproportionate to a cause. And that is a totally different ball game, because forecasting irrationality is much more difficult than forecasting irrationality of your adversary. Do you think that will make Russia's policy more risk-averse or, on the contrary, more daring?
So I wouldn't call it irrationality. We can doubt or challenge the main premise that Russia did intervene. But as you said, now for Americans, it's fact of life. We should take it into account. They assume it happened. Profound mistrust will persist. At the same time, based on conceptual documents issued by Trump administration since December last year, we see that the Cold War approach and mentality is completely back in full scale. They basically repeat the same as Reagan administration or administrations before him. Which means that we are in the situation of the Cold War when mechanisms of managing danger and managing risks were absolutely indispensable and essential. But in much worse situation when trust is non-existing because Americans believe that Russians are able to intervene in the core of their soul and so on. This is a very dangerous situation. I wouldn't call it irrational. It's something else. They believe in their rationality. We believe in our. So the main task is to try to re-establish some mechanisms of risk management, but with acceptance that this time we need to double or triple efforts to build up trust, because this trust is much worse than 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Lukyanov, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Fyodor Lukyanov, editor-in-chief of Russia in Global Affairs magazine. Mr. Lukyanov, you called Trump an operator of transition from extroversion to introversion in American policy, which you interpret not as isolationist, but rather as the prevalence of national interest over the global outreach. And from what I gather, you don't see that as a particularly positive development for Russia, even though Russia and to some extent China have long called for it. Is that an example of be careful what you wish for?
I don't think that anybody expected United States to make such a drastic turn to this America first. But what Russia dreamed about was a multipolar world. De facto, Trump's policy contributes to that, because if America says that global leadership is not needed anymore, and they try to become the strongest, the mightiest, but one of those countries operating on the world stage, that means that others will inevitably do the same. America first approach, when it comes from the United States, automatically generates me first world. Everybody is first. And of course, in this situation, these advantages are huge, because multipolar world per se is not a solution to anything. That's a chaotic, pretty dangerous competition. And we see that since United States abandoned this rhetoric of global leadership, it's even worse. The uncertainty and unpredictability has increased.
Well, since you mentioned disadvantages of that arrangement, let me ask you about the advantages, because the Russian diplomacy prides itself on its negotiating and consensus building skills. It considers itself as an heir to this Byzantine grand strategy, which is essentially, being a master of co-option, working both with friends and allies. And if that's indeed the case, I would think that this reformatting of the international system would offer the Russian diplomacy not only some very exciting opportunities, but also a very broad canvas to apply its skills. Is that the case?
This is the case, theoretically. In practical terms, we see in the Middle East, for example, where Russia is really uniquely situated to have good working relations with exactly all actors. It's the only country which can enjoy this. But it's not enough. We see how
it's
difficult
it is. It's not enough for what?
It's not enough for achieving results. We see even in Syria, how difficult it is to find common ground with Turkey, just with Turkey, not to talk about all other players involved. So Russia, again, Russia is better situated than others, but it does not guarantee any success. If we take the whole world, that's even worse, because countries which Russia sees as friendly, like China, which is true, China is very much friendly, but it does not mean that China is ready to compromise on any of their national interests.
But Mr. Lukyanov, I mean, it's essentially two polarities. Either one, somebody enforces his own vision on you, or you try to work out something that could benefit both sides. Obviously, the second one is far more laborious and no success is guaranteed. But I think what is really important to Mr. Putin, at least, is the principle. Because if you use the first option, it's not only unfair, I think, in the Russian worldview, but it is also highly detrimental because it simply increases the scope for potential mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. The first option is not an option for Russia. That is non-existing to take. It was an attempt in 1990s to make Russia part of somebody else's construction, which didn't work. It could not work. That was very, I don't know, naive to believe. But I think that Russian problem nowadays and in years to come, as problems for many countries in the world, is not of external nature. It's of internal nature. Russia has exhausted a certain model of development, which worked pretty well in the 2000s and early this decade.
You mean hydrocarbon rent and the not passive on,
not
political
only
passive
hydrocarbon
society?
Rent is just a part of this. I mean broader. I mean that Russian aim, starting from 91, even under President Yeltsin, under President Putin, under President Medvedev during all this time, was actually to get back to the table where the most important international decisions are being taken. And Russia, by using different means, Russia succeeded to get it. And that was, of course, reaction to the tragic collapse of the statehood in 1990. But now the question is, what next? What to do with this position? Russia is accepted in many cases with very bad feelings, but accepted as a part of this group of most mighty powers. And now Russia needs to understand for itself, why did we need it? Mm-hmm. Just for prestige or for some internal development?
Well, you may disagree with me, but my perception is that there is actually no controversy and full acceptance among the Russian ruling elite that you have to build the country from within. And that actually involves partially some liberalization of the country, economic liberalization, the opening up of the system politically. The electoral laws on the eve of these presidential elections have been significantly eased. I think the discourse in Russia, the media discourse in Russia is also, it may be more polarized than before, but I think it's also freer than before. There is a greater influence of the internet and far more freer discussion on the internet, on the Russian public reality. I know you said a few years ago that Putin's main idea was to sort of push back against the US-led liberal democracy and give Russia some space to develop on its own accord. Don't you think that right at the time when the United States gave up on the idea of democratizing Russia, Putin picked that idea up, not necessarily as his own conviction, but simply as a method of country's development, as well as potentially a method of rehabilitating Russia on the global stage?
It's difficult to read in Mr. Putin's mind, and maybe...
But let's read the policies. I'm not asking...
No, but the policies are ambivalent, and which is understandable, because on the one hand, yes, I agree that there are signs of attempts to diversify the system. I wouldn't say open, because openness in today's world has so many backsides, so it's quite dangerous. But to diversify, to make it more sustainable and not to rely on one single person and one single institution, which is called Russian presidency. And I think all understand and all agree that it's needed. At the same time, again, very legitimate fear is that manageability of states in today's world is very much under pressure. And this is the biggest threat, biggest risk for any country, even for the United States, to lose control over what is going on. What happened in the Middle East, by the way, just confirmed that societies strongly centralized are not very much sustainable, but the opposite model is even worse.
You noted in several of your articles that the Western model of democracy is also undergoing some revision. There is a crisis of old political parties in the West. I think there is also a crisis of media, especially in the United States, when the media discourse takes over the political decision-making. I mean, there should be some mutual intermingling between the two, but when policy is led exclusively by media discourse, I think that's, we would agree, that's perhaps a recipe for disaster. Do you think Russia, even the Kremlin, even understands at this point what kind of model, it's most likely to be a hybrid model, but what kind of model it wants Russia to fit in?
I don't think there is a clear vision of a model. First of all, Mr. Putin is not a big strategic thinker, not because he's stupid, but because he's really, he's a fatalist. He believes in
the forces of history.
History, but also we live in such a transition time that everything is changing very fast, so to strategize almost doesn't make any sense because everything will change tomorrow. So in this regard, he is not about visions. He's about to try to be prepared for anything which can happen in the future.
Including his the necessity on his own part to step down from power, because that
absolutely,
is...
Absolutely. I think he, as many people around him, are aware that this next mandate will be the last one for him. He is not in mood to become Russian version of Robert Mugabe at all. He will just see it as his own failure if he will need to stay again. But of course, in the system like ours, where not just centralized system, but the system where for some objective reasons, the legitimacy of the state is very much tied to legitimacy of the president. It happened to be.
So essentially, you're saying that Putin's last term in office will be geared towards Putin overcoming the effects of the Putinism, the system that he himself has created?
To a certain extent, not to overcome, but to transform. I don't think he will abruptly leave and, so to say, go to pension somewhere in mountains. He certainly will try to make it as he likes to do normally, step by step. But that's enormous challenge because Russia, as it emerged after in 21st century, basically, this is Russia very much characterized by Putin's person. And it will be very difficult for this person to start to decouple himself from the state.
Especially when the international pressure is so significant. We talked about Russian foreign policy in the first part, and I think sometimes building a relationship across the globe is easier than being on good terms with your own neighbors. There was mutual irritation building between Russia and Europe, Russia and Ukraine, long before 2014. But I think since then, it became an open wound. We are marking the fourth anniversary of the Maidan uprising this week. Do you see any way out of the current predicament?
I don't see any way out just now. The many reasons. There is a pretty bad political situation in Kyiv. I don't see any responsible forces there who would be interested in moving forward on the reconciliation. I don't see, frankly, any bigger interest in Russia. I don't see at all European role, which is very bad. But looking at, for example, political mess in Germany, suddenly Germany, which used to be driving force for all this Minsk process, is now so much introvert and they are busy with domestic affairs. They have no time and energy. And paradoxically, the only remaining line is again between Russia and the United States. And Surkov-Volker communication is almost the only one which can produce anything. And I hope actually that it will do, because Americans, with all understandable claims on the Russian side, but Americans are at least able to do something, to achieve something, unlike Europe. Mm-hmm. But for the foreseeable future, my only hope is that the situation will remain stable, the status quo will remain without major drastic changes.
Well, on this very sobering note, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time today. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on World Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.